Welcome to the Directing Animation Livecast with Scott Weiser, who has gone from a studio of one to directing at Space Station Animation to supervising at Steamroller Animation, continuously developing over 15 feature film pitches on a quest to master the art of making deeply meaningful animated films. Today's episode is unlike any other I've ever done. Several months ago, Jordan Curley, who is the producer of the Tuttle Twins and has purchased the Salt Lake Animation Expo, which is really making an impact. It's a really awesome expo. I would check it out if you're anywhere near here. She asked me to host a couple panels in collaboration with the Directing Animation Livecast. So the first panel was the one you heard about in the Chris Wall episode. We had a panel of showmakers who talked about their process of creating shows. Unfortunately, because of technical difficulties, Chris Wall couldn't get much of his opinion into the panel, and we didn't have footage that we could show on the Directing Animation Livecast. But this second one was a discussion about AI, artificial intelligence, and the recording went well, and we're able to share it with you here today. Now, we say AI and a lot of emotions come out, right? And we cover this very well in the discussion. We tried to present all of the sides, tried to get all of the perspectives onto the table as we discussed this. And since recording this, I've noticed that a judge dismissed the case against Midjourney, and they may keep trying to push the case, but it isn't looking very promising for us to, you know, the artists who are really hoping to kind of smack down Midjourney and not let it happen. It might actually be here to stay, and it's getting better and better as a technology. However, you know, my dream when I saw artificial intelligence, the moment I saw it, I thought, okay, this is what I've been looking for. I've wanted to create beautiful, deeply meaningful films with a small team of people and release those films out into the world and you know, create many of them. And this technology looks like it's gotten us closer to that goal. At the same time, when I started using it, I felt very sick to my stomach about it. I could see there were a lot of ethical issues. There were a lot of issues that took a lot of the human component out of the work. So my goal, as I've been wrestling with all this information, is to find a very human way to interact with this. And I think the technology actually has a way, if we use it responsibly, to, you know, maybe make us better humans, maybe be free up time so we can go in and interact with the world more and be better humans in that way. Jordan Curley, after the recording of this production ended, she did bring up a good point that didn't get recorded, so I'm going to share it with you now. There was a short film about Scooby-Doo that was a Halloween little special that this animator created almost everything on his own. He created all this stuff in Blender. It was a pretty brilliant project in a way. Obviously, he doesn't own the Scooby-Doo IP, so he probably might get in trouble that way. And he used AI voices, which made people very mad and created this backlash that damaged this animator's career. So yes, we do have to be very responsible as we use this and move forward with it. And I mean, I think at very least it can kind of remove a lot of the, you know, I'm still working animation, and there are some times that the process of animating becomes, it feels a little bit like grunt work. It feels really monotonous. And so it could help remove that, right? At the same time, there's a beauty in the monotonous work that changes the way you view the art, which I think we might lose something in that. So, I mean, for me, the challenge for me will be, how do we use this technology in a way that we still keep the beauty and the discovery and the benefits of the work and also, you know, utilize the technology so we can make better entertainment and live better lives. So, very interesting discussion. I'm happy. I'm very open about it. If anybody wants to discuss it, wants to come on the show and discuss it. Here's the discussion. Enjoy it. Engage with it. Let us know what you think of it. None of these opinions are final from anybody. Everybody's still exploring this together. And thank you for being here. Enjoy. And we have a wonderful panel for you today. I know this is a touchy subject. That's why we labeled it AI, is it good or evil? And we're really gonna dive in and try to cover every facet of that we can. And then we'll open it for questions so that you can ask as well. For our guests today, we have Dana Ware. Dana Ware is the, chief creative officer of Around. It's a company that creates augmented experiences for stadiums. And she's also, you're still an advisor, and you worked at The Void, which creates virtual reality content for Disney and Sony. So very depth, great depth of experience there. Then we have Michael Murdoch. Michael Murdoch dreamt of getting to animation, creating Lord of the Rings, and got to work on some great big projects and at Sony, and then went to Blue Sky, was a lighter there, and then created a company called Continuum that creates AR and virtual reality experiences as well. And then we have Chaz Wagaman, who owns Digital Gravy, is an excellent illustrator, and partnered up with a guy who's an animator, and they created a great company that has worked on projects such as Tuttle Twins, animation for that, and the Church of Jesus Christ Covenant Path series, and all over, all kinds of projects in various different styles of animation. And then we have, oh, not to be forgotten, it's almost like this character doesn't exist, but now he does. We have Albert Indigo, who is AI. And I think you communicate to him by typing in, right? Okay, awesome. So this will be an interesting experience. I mean, maybe this is the most controversial part of the experience, but we'll ask some questions. We'll get to experiment with AI and ask it questions and hear its answers. So let's go ahead and let's start with a question about where each of the panelists sit. What do you think of AI?
I'm probably the person that is going to be the most, you're not going to be able to really like pin me down. Because depending on the application, depending on which type of AI we're talking about, how it's being used, I either feel incredibly passionate and strong, or I'm still figuring it out. So I think that a lot of us are kind of still figuring it out in some ways. But yeah, you might not be able to pin me down as being a like lover or hater of it just across the board.
That's okay.
I have some different opinions.
All right, I'll just for the sake of I guess it's not debate, the conversation, I'll probably say that I lean a little bit more on the positive side of AI, but I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it. I think there's the moral side, there's the legal side, and then there's just like the value. And I think really at the end of the day, the value is still gonna always be in the artist and in the human, and that's why we want art in general. And my hope is that AI will eventually be a regulated and legal way to enable artists to help us connect better. And if that can happen, which maybe is too idealistic, then I'm all for it. But I'm not for, you know, copyright and stealing and stuff like that. So there's certainly some nuance to it that we're, I think, all as an industry trying to figure out. So again, I'll probably lean more on the positive side of things with like that caveat of, okay, as long as it's right.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I think I feel similarly, but I feel pretty optimistic, pretty excited about the possibilities of AI. I mainly work in 2D animation, and I don't know how it will be useful, but I'm really excited about figuring out how I can use it to allow us to make more, better, more interesting content faster, and eliminate kind of the grind of what we do. So I kind of feel like we're like the angel and the devil sitting here on my shoulders. but I'm excited. I certainly am aware that there are a lot of cons to this new technology, but mostly I'm excited.
Oh, go ahead.
Am I the angel or the Lord
of
the Devil?
She's the ambiguous. We'll discover later on in at the climax maybe what she is. So anybody, out of anybody in the group, as we had our discussion preparing for this, I'm probably the most against it. But I do kind of sit more where you sit, where the moment I saw it, I thought, I've always wanted to create.
It is a tool that can be used for various purposes, and it is an opportunity to deploy. The ethical responsibility lies with us, the creators and users of the AI, to ensure positive impact.
Nice. Well, we've established that AI is rude and interrupts us. Like, no, I'm just kidding. Great answer, AI. Thank you. Awesome. Yeah, so where I sit on the subject is I was very excited when it came to automation and that sort of thing and ways to kind of speed up our process, maybe lower costs on process. But anytime I dove in and tried to use AI, I ended up sick at the end of the day. There's just something that just hasn't been sitting right with me on it. And I've written lots of notes and done a lot of investigating. So out of anybody here, I'm probably the most against it. And I'll have some thoughts on that later on. Just so you know, we're going to represent hopefully everybody's viewpoint in this, and if we don't, then you can come and ask the question at the end, okay? So, now that we go from there, what is the biggest issue that you would see with AI? The biggest negative?
Yeah, obviously it's a copyright infringement that can happen, stealing ideas and people's hard work that they've spent years crafting and mastering. It's an ethical question, right? It's a tricky one because I feel like if we are going to lean into this, technology is not going to go away. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like the blanket statement of realizing that we are coming to a new frontier with how these tools are going to be used. With every other kind of revolution, industrial revolution that we've had, it shifted markets. It shifted jobs. It shifted how industries have developed. It's closed down certain types of jobs, and it's created space for new types of jobs. So I think we're kind of in that gray zone right now where we don't fully understand exactly what's happening or how it will be utilized. We don't have any laws in place to make it ethical currently, but I don't think that it will stay that way forever. And so we are in this wishy-washy point of having to figure out how to do it in a way that is good for everyone and good for mankind and helps to push us forward and unite us as opposed to turn it into something which we currently are seeing with the strikes.
Yeah.
The strikes in Los Angeles, of the writer strike, the acting strike, like these are partly due to some of the ways that they wanted to utilize AI to eliminate some of the writers or use background actors as AI characters as well, too. So there's all these different applications that people are trying to come up with to kind of streamline, like you were kind of mentioned, that's been
yeah.
kind of mentioned here. And it's true that that's a real process, but how do we do it ethically is the question I have.
Let's ask AI.
One of the biggest issues with AI is the potential for paralysis. AI systems can inadvertently find and amplify new biases present in the data they are trained on. This can be unfair as a system to carry out in areas like hiring, lending, and criminal justice. Addressing bias requires diverse representation of training and data, transparent algorithms, and unknown monitoring and evaluation. Ensuring fairness and mitigating bias is crucial for responsible AI deployment.
Okay.
Very interesting. I do think there's probably already quite a bit of bias in content creation, so maybe I agree with them to an extent. But anyways, so the original question was, biggest problem with AI?
Yeah.
I would say, honestly, for me, in the art realm, it's kind of what I've referred to, at least a lot to my team, is kind of like the robocall of art. I think the barrier to entry being lowered so quickly is going to make it feel like, you know, when you get a robocall, like you instantly dismiss it, you're so annoyed, and I think there's going to be a lot of artwork out there that's kind of going to feel similar for a while as people are able to create websites and social media and, artwork, maybe cartoons or whatever, that is fully generated with AI. It's going to feel like we're just inundated with stuff that wasn't, curated by people who have been doing it and grinding and understanding and learning. They're just thinking, oh, I can just type a prompt and make something that's beautiful, but they don't even know what's wrong with it or if there's something wrong with it. You know, even if we understand deeply why there's a difference between, a straight to like streaming crummy ripoff animated thing that shouldn't exist versus something that thousands of people put years into, very, very different, but it's hard as an outsider to know what those minute differences are. And so yeah, as people have more access to easier tools, we're just going to get inundated with a lot of probably poor art. But ultimately, I think it still goes back to the fact that by enabling the true artists, we will actually find that there is some art that will raise to the top, but that might take a while.
I don't know that I have much to add to that, but I think, yeah, to Dana's point, I think that's the biggest issue is that people have spent their lives crafting a look and a style and a feel and a message, and now anybody can just be like, yeah, me too, and they can just click a button and it kind of happens. I think that's certainly the worst that I'm seeing. But yeah, also the overwhelming wave of mediocre art, and it's going to be not fun. I've experimented a lot with Midjourney and using it as part of my painting process. I'm also a digital painter, and I've done kind of photo bashing for years. You know, I'll take photos, copyrighted photos, I'll take those, I'll chop them up, and I'll put them in my image, and then I paint over top of those, and I make them fully unique and original. Right? But I feel, now I can do that with Midjourney, right? And I feel better about that, because it's not coming from something that was truly copyrighted before, right? What was my point?
You're going into the good side of it, but that's okay.
I didn't mean to. I just got excited.
He's the angel, we know.
Yeah. No, I'm the devil, I think. But yeah, I lost my train of thought. Sorry, but... my point was, I've been using it, and I like to use it, right? But when I see AI art just come at me, like on Instagram, or an album cover, or whatever it is, there's something that just feels really gross. Like, immediately, I can recognize it was created in Midjourney. I know the things to look for, and I just immediately feel gross about it, even though I'm using it. Hopefully, in a better way. I don't know.
Yeah, we even had a discussion about how there's some images that have really impressed me enough to pin them on Pinterest, right? But then I come back and I look at it, and I'm like, it lost its luster, like that initial response. Whereas when I see a John Singer Sargent painting, my reverence for that painting deepens and deepens and deepens and gets deeper as I get older, right? Another negative that we should probably bring up is, well, not even a negative, but I kind of have started to theorize since our last discussion that there's possibly a bell curve of where you sit on the bell curve might, in your progression in your career, might be how you feel about AI. So if you're a new student beginning out, you can see Midjourney does this and I draw like this, you know, is it even worth me learning to draw? That, you know, it could create a little bit of a hopelessness in you, right? Or maybe you're somewhere in the middle of your career where you're excited about it, you're not sure what you think about it, or you're somebody who's just really excited about it because you don't feel threatened, maybe. But then I noticed there's some people who, on the other side, like Tom Moore, who directed The Secret of Kells, Wolfwalkers, and Miyazaki, who they have very strong reactions to it. And, you know, I think we've probably all seen the clip of Miyazaki when he first saw AI, and he was disgusted by it. He said it was an insult to humanity. And granted, the thing was like this little monster crawling around on the ground, but they showed him more in the meeting. And when he went home, he just started drawing. He was like, humanity is losing faith in itself. You know, and I think that's one issue that a lot of us don't talk about is our confidence. I've been working on certain things where I get to a hard problem and I'm like, why don't I just have Midjourney solve this, right? And I don't, you know. I try to go for the actual human struggle because it will be a better human piece of art, right? But I think that's super important to know that maybe where you sit in your career might have something to do with that. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dana? Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And it's a hard, this is where I'm going to be great again, okay? Just so I know. I feel like we talked about how there's this opportunity for it to level the playing field, right? In the sense of like, maybe it'll help people get into the industry because it allows them access in certain ways. Maybe they're not mastered at something, but they can like get their foot through the door because they at least have learned a little bit of how to use the tool to help them get through the door. So there is that question of like, is that good? Is that good? And it's like, given somebody who, you know, there's always these job postings that are like, you must have, it's an entry-level position, but you have to have 15 years of experience in order to get it, right?
Yeah.
You see those postings all the time. And I wonder if this will kind of level up and build out a little bit so that there's less gatekeeping. But at the same time, the second part of that is I understand where we saw this coming from, in the sense that it took him, you know, decades to like figure out the style and master it and to and perfect it, and he sold so many copies and people love his work. I mean, my daughter makes him watch his movies all the time on repeat. Like, they're great, they're beautiful, and there is humanity in them.
Yeah.
Deep, deep, deep stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand where he's coming from, because it feels like something that has taken him so long to craft, and it's his way of connecting with people, right? And he is a master of this art form. And so to see other people be frivolous with that connection is probably really impactful for him to
okay.
watch, right?
Yeah.
Because art is, like, as an artist, I started off as an artist, like, hands-on making stuff, and I still do to this day, but, like, my livelihood was dependent on me getting it out the door, right? It was my only skill, my own hands. Today, as a creative director, I still do things with my hands, but I'm also directing a lot of people. So I'm working with a lot of artists. It's a different type of relationship with art at this point, too. But I can tell you, like, it's my way of communicating still with people. It's how I make connections with other people. And I've had many people come up to me and tell me how, like, an experience that I made helped them have this everlasting memory of their father who just recently passed away, and they're in tears telling me how much they just appreciate that experience that they got to go through and how they'll always have that memory. And that's profound for me.
Yeah.
That tells me that it made an impact in their life.
Absolutely.
So even though I'm not using my skills like to save the world, I'm using my skills to make connections for people and through people. So I understand where he's coming from. And that's where the ethical part, again, comes in. It's hard for me because I'm like, opening up barriers to entry, we need to do that because it's too hard for people to be able to make a living. But then on the other side, like, you have to know what you're looking at to know what's good, too, right? So I always tell people who tell me that they're using ChatGPT to write code, I'm like, you want to be the person who wrote the code to make ChatGPT. Not the person who's dependent on ChatGPT to get you through your job at the end of the day. Because what if it goes down, someone's still gonna expect work from you by the end of the day. So you need to know how to be better than the tool that you're using. And I think that's where, like, getting an education, becoming a master yourself, is really still a key part of being able to understand how to use the technology ethically again.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great, and I love those points, and I think I agree with the vast majority of that. And I think to even go further, like with students and stuff, if you think of like a mathematician, somebody studying math, like try and limit the use of the calculator as long as humanly possible to understand the fundamentals, so that your brain is actually wired that way. I mean, now I like don't even pull out a calculator; I just ask Siri or Alexa to tell me what a calculation is. But I think learning that early on gave me kind of the building blocks, and I'm not a mathematician now, but but had I been, I would have needed those building blocks. And as artists, I would say, especially if you're a student, try to avoid it probably at all costs. Like literally probably try and get physical paint and understand the additive properties of paint and color and how that works and why that resonates. And I think, as I've thought about this a lot, I mean, I'm a very nostalgia-driven individual, and the Rankin-Bass animations, like Rudolph Red-Nosed Reindeer and stuff, if you guys are familiar with that, I think the reason those resonate aren't because they're good animation, they're janky, and kind of not very attractive to a degree. There's a lot of great art that's in there, but relative to what we have today, right? But it still resonates because you can like feel the fingerprints that are in the characters, and you see the fluff of the fur. And as a 7-year-old or 6-year-old, whatever, like, I didn't know that I was looking at that, but there was something that I didn't realize was connecting me to another human who had created something. And I think with AI, the risk that Miyazaki's probably concerned about is losing that human connection through the form of art. I would assume that that's it. You know, losing those little tiny fingerprints in the clay and in the fur. Those things matter. We don't even know they matter, but as artists, we're trying to connect the world through a visual medium. And AI is not going to connect us to a human, just like social media doesn't really connect us to a human.
Good point.
It's those extra things, that those extra fingerprints that do matter. And I think the human touch is where that's at. And that can't be replaced by an AI. It's actually impossible, right? So it doesn't matter how good it gets. If you can just tell ChatGPT, like, make me Avatar 4, and it just makes it, there's still going to be that loss of the fingerprints. And so,
I agree with that. And I think that's what helps me feel pretty safe and confident, at least for the time being, is that, you know, there's that lack of humanity in the work. We're talking about that bell curve, and I'm trying to kind of put myself, you know, where am I at? You know, I own a studio, I have employees. There's certainly something that's exciting to me, being a business owner, like, oh, we can get more done, potentially, right? And I it's not even crossed my mind, like, that, oh, I could get rid of my staff. I could just get rid of them, and then I could just make all the stuff myself, I guess. I'm never gonna do that. But the idea that we can go faster, we can make more, we can iterate faster, we can put more of our humanity in, is really exciting to me. So I don't know where that sits on that bell curve, but that's one perspective I have. I have the perspective of being an artist myself. I think I'm actually really grateful that I didn't kind of echoing what you guys were saying, I'm grateful I didn't have AI when I was like in school and like learning my craft, right? And I'm no master by any means, but like I've learned how to paint, I've learned how to illustrate, I've learned how to animate. And so when I see AI produce something that's off, I know exactly what's wrong, and I can just go fix it, you know? But I've been honing the craft a little bit. I do worry that if I had that tool early on, I would be maybe using it as a crutch and not knowing how to fix it. Just, yeah, it looks good to me, I guess, right? So I'm a big proponent of, like, learn your craft so that you can cheat to win. Cheat ethically, but I used to be really precious about a lot of things in art. I'm becoming less so at the time. I think there's certain things to be precious about. There's certain things that are just tedium, just got to do, especially in animation, right? So that's kind of my perspective. I'd love to know what Indigo thinks.
Yes, there may be a number of assignment of AI on the art students based on their first stage. Beginning students may be curious and eager to explore AI's creative possibilities. Intermediate students might be more excited, as they gain technical skills and see AI as a tool for experimentation. Advanced students could be less enthusiastic, having already explored AI extensively and potentially seek more traditional artistic expressions. However, individual preferences and interests can vary, and not all students may follow it as a preferred pattern. The perception of loss in age.
I'm glad we lost that age. I was hoping it would go away. I love that. Thank you, Albert. Such a great answer. I actually have a quote from a master, right? That actually pertains to this, but this was when Miyazaki was asked, why are you doing hand-drawn animation in a CG era? And I think this applies to what we're talking about. This was really cool. He said, most classic silent movies were created after talkies were developed. And looking back at history, we can see there was a sudden boom in demand for sailing ships right after the invention of steamships. In other words, with technological innovation, if there is a broadening of the overall base, then the demand for overall technologies increases. And even if it doesn't, I like to draw by hand on paper. So I can't imagine the demand for everything hand-drawn will disappear. And that's the approach I intend to continue to take. Having so said, it is true that Ghibli films use lots of computer graphics, just as American animation productions do. There is no question that computer graphics are a promising tool for us. The issue is how this tool is used. When turning a three-dimensional real-world image into a flat two-dimensional image, the result is an expression of the artist's way of viewing the world, even of his or her way of thinking. If people become fixated on using computer graphics to pursue a greater sense of realism, I fear that it may help to cancel out a diversity of thoughts and ideas. As long as I continue to work as a creator, I cannot ever imagine relinquishing my own way of seeing the world. Cool quote. Does anybody have any thought on that? Dana, she's nodding her head.
I have lots of thoughts. I mean, it reminds me of my own kind of personal journey as an artist, because I started off in photography. And as a 15-year-old, I was supporting myself. Like, I had my own apartment, everything, doing photography. I was, like, hustling, because that's how I had to make my living. And I was good. And I was able to win lots of awards. And I printed things in darkroom rooms. I worked for Kodak. I've worked on a lot of different types of hands type, material,
yeah,
photography, medium format, using emulsion, like everything, right? I've been in darkrooms for like way too many hours and still have burns on my skin from some of the chemicals I used back then, right? And then all of a sudden, there were smartphones with really fancy cameras and everyone was a photographer. And it completely changed my industry. And I could not survive anymore the same way I used to. It was really tricky for me to be able to make money. I was living in Los Angeles and it's very expensive in LA. And so all of a sudden I had to like reevaluate my life and how am I going to actually make money and what are the tools that I need? Because everything that was coming out was fast, quick, easy digital. Right? It was like, oh, I can just hold a button down in this rabbit fire and I'll just probably get lucky on one of them. Where that was never the case for me. I had to like plan out every single shot because I had film that I was working with and it was very expensive for me. And so it changed how people interacted with photography. It changed how photography was produced and consumed. Everything has shifted in that industry. And I guess my point being that all of a sudden, there was like this point where I saw that people were going back to medium format. Weddings are being shot again on actual films. And films are being shot on actual film stock. And
absolutely.
I remember there being this like push to like find filters for, I also studied film at UCLA as well. And so I was very much, I'm from the film industry too. And I remember there was, at that point, there was this push to like have filters, digital filters that could simulate film stock. So it could look like film again, right? Because there was this need for that grittiness and the rawness of the film stock.
Yeah.
People were gravitating towards that look for a while, but it didn't feel authentic. And so you saw people trying to scramble to find more film stock so they could actually shoot their films in real film, but like Kodak, you know, they stopped producing a lot of that stuff because no one was buying it anymore. And so it's this weird situation for me. So I feel like I probably relate more to understanding how you, this like specific art form that you were so intimately involved with has shifted to not be the craze anymore. But then it kind of came back and now it's kind of rare to find people who actually ever shot on film or have ever been in a dark room. So, yeah, I don't know. I relate, I guess.
So, I had a thought that is escaping me right now. I do think that, if you look at like Phil Tippett, he was like also a claymation animator. He kind of went through a similar evolution where you're no longer creating creatures. You remember on Jurassic Park, and they pivoted to digital, and it was devastating for him. And Spielberg kept him on, but his whole industry kind of collapsed. But he came from just like a half dozen people that were doing that in the industry, and now you think of how many people there are that are doing digital creatures on computers, and that has just exploded. So as bad as I feel for Phil Tippett and people maybe like Glenn Keane too, if you follow him and like his 2D journey a little bit, like they didn't necessarily evolve in the traditional way that most artists did to kind of ride the wave of CG. But they also had something that was just historically valuable to the industry and kind of had a falling out, I guess. I don't know. I'm putting words in their mouth, so go ahead.
I just want to say something to Phil Tippett, because that's a really good point.
Yeah.
So Phil Tippett looked like he lost his job, but they were really struggling with getting the technology to work and stuff. And so Phil Tippett is actually still working in the industry. And they hired him back because he had the knowledge and other people had the knowledge of how to get this thing to really work. And it's because of that artistic mastery, this comes back to that point that you brought up. The artistic mastery is really what kept him moving back into the industry. If he was just completely dependent on a certain technology, and then we went from one technology to the other, he probably wouldn't have survived as well. But he went back to those foundational skills.
Yeah, like they actually made a robot, like a Marquette robot that connected to the computer to drive the animations, because the renderings looked better than the claymation, but they couldn't get the animation right. And since Phil knew it, he was able to kind of adapt and evolve. So yeah, very cool story. Looking to Phil Tippett and that kind of evolution. And I honestly do think it's similar to all the things we've been talking about, is that there'll be this kind of like, oh no, all our jobs are gone because Midjourney can just take them. And then we'll realize, no, the things that inherently made us valuable as artists have to be infused into whatever it is for whatever reason to create the whole reason we've had it, like, all along. So, anyways.
Yeah, as Daniel was talking about, like, everybody can all of a sudden shoot photos, right? I was just thinking, oh, well, yeah, then you gotta find a way to stand out, I guess, right? If everybody can do it, well then how do you stand out? And it's a challenge and it's scary and it's something I'm genuinely terrified of my industry getting overrun by AI. How do I stand out? It's kind of funny and ironic, I think, that like, okay, well if I just do it the traditional way, now all of a sudden I'm standing out almost, right? Shooting on film. And I guess that's how I feel a little bit with animation. Like, oh, well if I just do it the hard way, if I do traditional animation, hand drawn, that's kind of the hard way. Maybe that helps me stand out, right? But I guess I almost take it as, it also excites me. It's like, all right, challenge accepted. Yeah, let me do it. Let me figure out how to stand out in this industry. So it's scary, but I get excited about it.
A cool story, Armand Serrano is a great artist in the industry. He's worked for all the studios and sometimes multiple studios per year. Incredible artist. I'm going to have him on the live cast in November, I believe, or October. And he, one day he was at CTNX and these students were watching him work and they're like, how are you doing that? It's because students were so shifted into the digital realm that when he was drawing with a pencil, they were just like, how in the world are you doing it? And he lifted it up and said, it's a pencil. It's called a pencil. He was just kind of baffled. But it's because, you know, these students really hadn't thought about fundamentals. And I think that's why, maybe if we're on the earlier part of the bell curve, why we would feel threatened is because we maybe need to go back to those fundamentals and learn from them. Let's talk a little bit about ethics, which is probably one of the most important things we can talk about. So, there's a story about a guy in Brazil. Oh, we're going to ask you. Sorry, I almost forgot about Albert. Does he really exist?
The uses of AI in generating art and indeed the legal perceived laws of the human element. AI lacks the subjective experiences, emotions, and intentions that humans bring to the creative process. However, whether there will continue to be a demand for analog art versus AI art in the future is a subject that is uncertain. While some may prefer the uniqueness and personal touch of analog art, others may appreciate the novel and innovative nature of AI-generated art. It is possible that both forms will coexist and that there is a different process, allowing for a diverse art landscape.
All right. So, in Brazil, there was this guy who he stole money, but he only stole one penny from you, and one penny from you, and one penny from you, and it ended up being lots of money. And so the banks didn't catch on to this until they kind of all got together and realized that this guy was collectively stealing from everybody, right? Luckily we caught him, right? Right now, we have a situation where it's considered ethical by some to scrape the internet, which is to go and gather data from the internet and then use it to create certain things. And that's where we got Midjourney from. One reason Midjourney progressed faster than everybody else is because it was able to scrape a lot of really good artists. And there's Carla Ortiz is a name you might want to Google someday. Carla Ortiz has created a lawsuit that I think she's even spoken before Congress about this, about the ethics of AI. So let's have that discussion. Like, what are we supposed to do with the ethics? How should we think about the ethics?
Yeah, I have this hope and desire that at some point some of those tools will spit out a works cited sheet alongside the art that you get. So you don't just get a piece of art, you get a piece of art with like just like an academic paper. It comes with a whole bunch of works cited, like where this came from and the percentage and who and where you can find it and a link directly to it, because it's doing that already. So it can just spit that out as well alongside the art that you're getting. But there's also the other part of the ethics part of having artists that opt into having their work scraped, right? Like you can become an artist that says, okay, sure, scrape my art, or not. I think that's a method that a lot of game studios actually use today inside of their studios. They'll have a bunch of artists who are working with AI, but they're using their own art. So it's like internal art that's being scraped to produce more internal art. And it's to try to become more effective at their job, efficient, to get the pumping out faster, but also just to iterate, because most artists, they make one loot box. They don't want to have to make 350 loot boxes and just sit there and whip them all out. But if you can feed this algorithm and have that happen internally within like a certain studio with its own image branding, that's a great efficiency, right, for that studio and for that artist alone. So I think it's how you think about ethics, how you treat the artist, and what artists are willing to do, and how they're willing to participate. But again, we're so early in these discussions. Like I remember when drones hit the scene, and there were no laws, and people were just like flying in the side of buildings, flying at like public venues where they could crash into like crowds of people because there were literally no laws, right? When evolution of technology comes up, we're kind of not ready for it half the time. And so we're kind of at that stage right now with AI. We don't really know how to ethically use it quite yet.
Yeah, there's definitely, I'm going to reserve the right to be on the wrong side of the fence with this because we're too early. But when you do think about things like copyright, fair use, parody, and things like that, it is a very nuanced law, and I think that as a new technology like Google came around and they started posting pictures that you could search online for like the Mona Lisa, and you could see the Mona Lisa. They didn't own it. They didn't ask Da Vinci if they could use that, but it was a new way to do it. And if you look into fair use, there's kind of different ways that you can essentially justify using someone else's work, whether it's for inspiration directly, you know, shifting colors. You think of someone like Andy Warhol and how he did that to large success. As a society, we kind of tend to lean towards the things that we deem to be ethically okay. The laws kind of come as a result of maybe what we feel is all right, but in this case, there are no laws currently, so we're kind of maybe wayfinding a little bit ethically as to what we think is okay. And it seems like from the artist's perspective, and understandably so, there's a lot of moral opposition to it, which I totally understand and empathize with. And a lot of that's probably fear-based. And I just want to echo what Chaz said earlier. You know, I own a studio, have employees, have concept artists, and I never for a second thought, oh, now that AI is out, I'm going to let one of these guys go. It's not even crossed my mind. It's all just been, hey, now this guy's going to be a little bit faster in certain tasks, but not overarching. Like, it can maybe do like 3% of what I ask him to do, if that. And so, anyways, I understand the fear. The ethics and the legalities of it, I think, are just still on the fence, still being determined and have to be. And for true long-term staying power of AI, it's going to have to be something that collectively we feel good about, so that when we look at whatever's generated with the use of AI, we don't feel gross. I think it was Secret Invasion was the Disney Plus show that the intro titles were all made with AI. And there was some public backlash. People didn't like it. They were, especially with all the strikes going on, they're like, man, this is a cheap shot. And people didn't like it. And I would imagine that people are going to not create AI-generated, at least explicitly obvious AI-generated intros for a while. So art is subjective and needs to be led by society and a community. So I think it's a lot to be determined.
just to talk about the secret invasion thing, you had mentioned that to me earlier, and I hadn't seen it, so I haven't watched it. I think it kind of points to Indigo's point here, where he was talking about, you know, sometimes maybe AI art will be appreciated for what it is on its own. I actually haven't watched Secret Invasion, so I can't speak to it very specifically, but like, I don't know, it seemed like they were trying to do something that was fairly intentional. Right, aliens, technology, something like that, right?
Yeah.
And I suppose, like, I think an intro to iRobot all done in AI would be intentional and cool, and it'd be interesting all of its own. So I think intent and purpose, right? Let's see. I mean, as far as regulations, I don't have much to add to that. I think a lot of great things have already been said. Yes, I think ethically sourced data sets is what it's all about. So I do think the mid-journeys of the world should be regulated. I'm happy with what Adobe's doing. That seems to be a much healthier approach. They're, you know, sourcing their artists, their own personal data set, and I believe the money is supposed to go back to those users when their stuff is being sourced. I don't know if that's actually how it's worked out, but I'm sure it's fractions of a penny. It's probably not that much, but it's something. So I think that's a step in the right direction. Yeah.
Great. So this is a very liberal idea. So if there's anybody who later on wants to like debate it from more of a conservative angle, that's fine. I love the idea. So he was talking about how, imagine if when we had the Industrial Revolution, if what the owners of these car companies had done was more ethical like this. So rather than lay everybody off and just replace them with machines, and then, you know, those people end up getting jobs as auto technicians and that sort of thing. So a lot of them did land on their feet, and, you know, it kind of sorted itself at the hour. But imagine that you had, rather than just laying everybody off, you said, okay, I'm going to be making a ton of money here as the owner of the company, because now I have automation. So why don't I share it with you guys who helped me build this company? And I pay you the same amount. Then you can work less in the week. So we might need you for maybe 10 hours or, you know, half the time a week. What do you think of that? And then that could be a better approach. That could actually benefit everybody. The owner of the company would still make more money, but also show gratitude to the people who actually helped him build the company, right? There's a book by Simon Sinek called Leaders Eat Last. And he talked about how they had a situation where there was a company that they were in the red and they had to lay people off, but they came up with a better idea and everybody gets 1 month off a year without pay. So we find a way to lower the amount of spend, but you can choose where that month is and you can swap with people. And so there were some people who were like, I have more savings. So, and I know that you have, you know, you're a single mom with, you know, a couple kids. So I'm going to take your month and you don't even have to take it off. And people actually negotiated with each other and worked well together. So this concept of leaders eating last is, I actually think, a very ethical way of doing things. And I think that maybe that's possibly a way forward. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept because I am all about like helping other people find like new skills, right? So if you have people in your company and you think you might lay them off because of the fact that there's some type of new tool that's come out that's like made their job redundant or something. Training someone internally, I think, is a huge value, or like offering them some type of like benefits to be able to go get some additional education, whether it's like in that specific field or something different. I think that there's lots of different programs that employers can set up for that. It's interesting right now because everyone feels like we're going to a recession.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting conversation to have right this second, because I don't know when employers get scared that their bottom line is going to be affected, they probably think irrationally about those types of situations and more about trying to survive for the company. So it's, I think that our current economic situation that we're in right now, where people are nervous of a recession, might impact whether or not they choose to keep people on or get them retrained.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an incredibly, I feel like we could have like a 3-hour debate just on that one thing. So
yes.
I'll try and keep it light. I ultimately think I agree with the principle as like a business owner. If we were to have some massive exit, I would love for everybody that helped to be involved have almost like virtually equal, at least relative to contribution, you know, a home run for everybody. I'm definitely not a scarcity mindset individual. And I think that the implementation and enforcement of it is a little bit scary to me. But I think decentralization and letting all the artists be able to create this collective kind of whatever it is, whether it's a studio that's decentralized or something, and because everyone can be remote, everyone can contribute in their own way, it could be a really cool potential solution that we're all working 10 hours and consuming way more cool content and still making the same amount of money, because hopefully this guy doesn't want to take our jobs. Albert, wherever he went.
He's dead.
He's MIA.
he's taking our jobs right now. But so, yeah.
He's like, I got all the data I need.
Shut down the internet.
He's brilliant minds.
I don't think I have much to add to that. Is Indigo ready? Does he have any thoughts? Okay. I mean, I guess my only thought was like, I love that idea. I think that's awesome and beautiful and altruistic. People are selfish, and would it work? I don't know. I hate to be a downer or a pessimist about it, but yeah, go for it. I don't know. It would be an uphill battle.
Yeah. We can roll with that idea of people being selfish. At the same time, there's a saying that in entrepreneurialism, that you get what you negotiate for, right? And we're dealing with a lot. Let's say we have a company, and this is our company here, and we're the executives on the panel of the company. They can come to us with ideas too. So from your side as a workforce, rather than just going and striking and holding up signs, perhaps you can formulate a plan of like, I mean, if I were a business owner, I would be very impressed if somebody came to you with a plan of like, here's what we think we can do to help your company make money, to, you know, all unite together as a company and do this, and then pitch that to the business owner. So I don't think it's all on the business owner. It's not just that responsibility. I think it's the responsibility of all of us to have conversations where we can just say, hey, we want something out of this too. We know you're going to use this technology eventually. Here's how we would like to use it as well.
When you're talking about a small company, like a more indie company, yeah, you could probably have more one-on-one FaceTime with all of those people and come up with those plans. When you're thinking about it from like a studio level, mm-hmm. mass studios, I studied film at UCLA. The percentage of friends that I have on the picket lines right now is insane. I am in the PGA, and like, I have tons of friends being affected by this, like, today. And they are trying to come up with plans, and they're trying to make it so that they can actually have a conversation with the people who are in charge. But those people in charge, you have all these different studios with completely different directives and initiatives, and they're competitors with each other. Like, how do you get those people to get into a room and come to some type of consensus? Like, it's capitalism in its form that kind of makes us who we are as a society, but kind of runs some of these business ideas. And you think about just COVID alone, there are so many companies, including The Void, the company that I was the creative director for many years and an advisor for, but it's a new name company now because that company went bankrupt because there was no government funding to help us. I went and found a job from a Canadian company because Canada was giving money to studios. It was subsidizing artists' pay so the studios could actually stay around. So it's hard for me. I have friends who also own German companies that were able to survive during COVID and then now are flourishing post-COVID, right? Where I look at The Void, and we were the innovators of location-based VR. We were the ones that made it and created it. And then other people made their products. The German company, the Canadian company, they made their products based off of our stuff. And we're still struggling to this day. Were those other companies, that company technically is bankrupt, right? It's still bankrupt. But those other companies in those other countries that got financial support from their governments, are the ones that are actually surviving today. So yeah. I don't know that this is just an ethical question in us as workers trying to come together. This is like a larger systemic question of how do we function and support each other within a capitalist society and idealism.
Yeah, and I think that's great, yeah.
Thanks,
and I think that there's some ideas in there that somebody might object to, like maybe from more of a conservative angle. But even from that angle, if you look at why these countries are giving money to them, it's to stimulate the economy. It brings those jobs there. It brings business. It helps things to grow as an overall level. And so I don't think we should just ask for a government handout if you're worried about that from a conservative angle. But yeah, have these conversations and try to. Yeah, yeah.
Like there used to be art endowments for generations.
And right.
Where are they today?
Where are they? Yeah. Let's get them back. Stop spending money on some other things. Awesome. Did you have anything?
No, that was great. It's great.
That was awesome.
Yeah, we had John Neverez, who was a panelist a few panels ago, and he messaged us and was quite concerned about AI. And one of the things he said was, what is wrong with the current studio system? Why do we have to reinvent animation? And if you're going to reinvent animation, how do you protect the artists? How do you make sure that everybody gets, you know, at least the qualified people who are engaged in building the company, how they get that seat at the decision table? And I felt like that was a very important question. So anybody want to speak to that?
Well, just As a animation studio owner, my gut reaction to what is wrong with the animation, we're slow. That's what's wrong. Yeah. We're slow.
And expensive.
Yeah. Oh.
Nice.
Yay. Here, let's hear it for Jordan for putting this on. What were we talking about?
Slow music studios.
Oh, that was my gut reaction. I agree. I understand the sentiment of what he said, but that was just the one problem I'm always trying to solve, and this does help solve that.
And I think we're slow in ways that don't inherently bring value all the time. So when we're ideating, we're creating as artists, it's phenomenal and it's beautiful and it's awesome to be a part of. It's the best part of working in the industry. But when you're literally just like sitting there, like either entering in lines of code one after another, copy paste, that stuff needs to go as quickly as possible. Setting keyframes over and over again and dialing those in just to clean it up, not because it's adding any intrinsic value to the art form itself.
Yeah.
So anything that AI can take from that, I'm all for it for sure.
Repetitive things, right?
Yeah, those repetitive tasks. And that's been, you know, automation has been something that has been driving industries and innovation for a long time. And so if this is another one of those innovations, I'm all for it in that specific regard. So I don't think as a collective in like body of artists, there's anything wrong and that needs to be fixed that's currently broken that AI can fix. Other than speed.
Yeah.
Agree, but also know that I have to be realistic in saying that we're dealing in an international economy. And there are other countries out there that are gonna take these technologies who have no concern with stealing ideas at all, and they're gonna produce their stuff faster, and that's why the studios are concerned.
Yeah.
And it's partly because they know that some content is gonna be popping out of other countries and that it's gonna be coming faster and it's gonna come to your streaming devices. And that's where it is, right?
Yeah.
Because they can't probably pump it up just as fast in the traditional form. And I think that's why the conversation is happening.
Yeah. And they were already struggling before AI really made a splash onto the scene and it was hyped.
One more point to that. We also had COVID, right? Which closed down production. We also were in a strike today, which is closed down production. These concerns with those studios, they're only going to get bigger.
Yeah. So I had a conversation with somebody who I find to be very wise in the industry, and he pointed something out to me that's very interesting, that this is more of the broader topic of AI, not just AI as applied to artists, but I think it does apply to artists, because artists are kind of the conscience of the world, like society.
We're the ones who are kind of challenging things, pushing boundaries, right? So when, back in the day, when you wanted entertainment, you invited your friends over and you got your banjo out and you sang together and told jokes around a campfire or in the parlor. And then radio came along and something was gained and something was lost. It seemed like the quality of what you were getting was higher, right? But you were no longer putting out the talent. You were no longer doing human output. You were listening and looking around and smiling with your family, right? So you were having an experience with your family and it seemed like a really good thing, right? Well, the TV comes along and you're no longer looking around at your family, looking just at the TV and getting an audiovisual experience. And so something was gained and something was lost, right? Same with internet. So this is gonna be a two-part question, but I think it'll open something. We can go for a bit with this one. But when the internet came along, something that was gained and something was lost. We gained a lot of access to information, but the quality of that animation, or did I say animation? Information, the quality of that information went down, right? Oh, it happened again. So then, and it was actually kind of an AI in a way, with access to information, right? So it's kind of, it was big and had a big impact on the world. And social media came along and it made it easier to connect to people, but suddenly we're lonelier, right? So something's gained. It was a lot easier for me to sell my books and do a Kickstarter because I could contact people really fast, but something was lost in that we're kind of finding ourselves lost as humanity. And then we have another new innovation that is just as dramatic and big, which is AI. What is gained and what is lost? That'll be the question after we hear what Albert has to say about job losses due to AI.
To prevent job losses due to AI, 1, upskill and rescue workers. 2, provide education and training. 3, redesign jobs to focus on human skills. 4, support entrepreneurship. 5, establish social safety nets. 6, foster collaboration between industries, governments, and academia.
Okay. So we know one thing that's lost is how to pronounce words. But what else is gained? What is gained and what is lost from AI in particular?
Okay, so I mean, I feel like we're kind of repeating ourselves a little bit and saying that like that humanity aspect of it is lost. But you know, to the flip side of that, it is like forcing us to take a look at our actual skills. And what is it as a human that we bring to the table? And like leaning into that more, I think is the thing that we need to do. And you know, unfortunately, in some ways, I'm like, if you're passionate about something, if you are really into something, just like pursue it and become a master at it, whatever it is, because somebody will pay you to do it. Like when I was going to grad school, I had already started working in VR before I started. I went back to school to go to grad school. I got 2 master's degrees. And everyone was like, why do you care about VR so much? This was like a while ago, right? They're like, why do you care about VR? Why do you care about VR? And everyone naysayed me. And they're like, what are you doing? Why are you wasting your time with this? Like professors, students, I didn't really connect with many people. And to the internet point, like, I found my tribe not in Utah, not in the classroom. I found my tribe at like other conferences and speaking at places and being around other people who were actually making VR and AR until I got connected with The Void, right? And then all of a sudden I did have a tribe here in Utah. But prior to that, like I was by myself looking for people, scraping the internet, looking for my friends, right? And I'm grateful to the internet for giving you that access.
Mm-hmm.
But I was passionate about this thing that everybody was like, this is stupid. Why are you doing this? Why are you wasting your time? It's just a fad, like 3D glasses. You know how many times I've heard that? Like, but I still kept doing it. And I can tell you, like, right now, I'm, you know, it sounds slightly pretentious, but I've been doing it for so long that, like, I am one of the seasoned people. I speak at lots of conferences about this topic in particular, like international conferences. Like I know this really well, and it's because I'm passionate and I became a master at it, right?
Yeah.
And that's like my words of advice. If you're passionate about something, like, don't listen to any of us. Go do your thing and become really good at it. Become so good at it that like no computer can replace you.
Because yeah.
You are it. When I meet with people, like I've met with people from Disney and they're like, you are the thing you're passionate about. Like it spills out of me when I talk about the subject because that's how much I love it. So be that person. Become a master.
That's awesome and good to work with, you know, mirroring what we talked about in the last panel. But you have I was gonna say this. Oh, there's a TED talk I listened to about a guy who never got on social media, and they kept telling him, like, this is going to be a detriment to you. You're not going to be able to survive in the future world without being on social media. Like, if you're a business in today's world, you have to be on social media. He's told repeatedly. But what he did is instead of spending his time on social media, he spent his time becoming a master at what he was good at, and people found him. And then he ended up giving this TED talk and saying, you know, and it actually convinced me to go off of social media multiple times. I've now deleted Twitter, which I thought I would never do. So yeah, great, great thoughts on that. Did you want to add anything to that, Michael?
Yeah, so what's gained, what's lost? I think that there is so much that's learned through the grind, right? As you're just doing things over and over again. And that grind, if it is removed because we come faster and start using tools and use it as a crutch, we're going to lose a lot of just that time to like process and understand what is making us valuable. And at the same time, I think that it's going to just allow and enable a lot of people who do have something really substantial to contribute besides just man hours and mindless rotoscoping or mindless color filler, whatever it is, to create something phenomenal so quick. Like the fact that an individual can go out and make like an independent film with like basically the equipment in their backpack now versus what you could do in 1990, where you had to have an editing bay that was the size of like this room essentially, like, and cameras that were thousands of dollars. You know, now you can film something pretty substantial on an iPhone and edit it on a laptop all for like less than $5,000, and make something that's in better resolution and potentially better quality than what was made back then. So if you combine that with the grind and bringing something unique to the table, then we're going to be having better stuff than was ever produced. But getting there is tricky, and there's going to be a lot of mud along the way, a lot of just nasty stuff where people just have access to a camera and they upload it to TikTok, and then we find ourselves in the death scroll for hours and hours watching stuff that is somehow, we think, entertaining, I guess.
Mind-numbing.
Yeah, I mean, everything's just becoming more polarizing, right? I feel like with every technological advancement, we get a greater good, we get a greater evil. It just is going to continue. One thing Michael mentioned when we talked earlier is the inevitability of it. Like, it's going to happen. There's really, like, the train's already moving. You're not going to stop it. And so I am grateful for those that are fighting for regulation and keeping it as ethical as possible. I'm so grateful for them. I feel like personally, just my own time is best spent honing my craft. And I feel like a lot of time can be wasted complaining about the situation we're in now, and not embracing it. I feel like I'm afraid to lose time, right? Because there are those competitors overseas that they're gonna get sharper and faster because they're gonna embrace these tools. And so I want to embrace, I want to become better at my craft, and I just want that to be my area of focus, even though I know there's a lot of bad that comes with it. But I'm not gonna stop it, I can't stop it.
You're not gonna stop, I don't know why, I just bristle every time somebody says that. Like, maybe it's just because it's so obvious that it's like, there's no getting rid of it. It's always going to be here. Just kind of lie down and let the train run over you, you know? This is what it sounds to some people, you know? And other people are like, oh, it's not going anywhere, so we should use it, right? Ah, let's start asking for questions from the audience. This is a good point to break, too.
Awesome. I'm interested in this from, like, more of a philosophical standpoint. So when, like, Mary Shelley's brain is currently silent, created by man, and was basically demoralized, pushed to the ground to eventually become a monster and this down and got the monster. So bringing it back to AI, since AI isn't human, does that make it less than us? And creating AI with a view that is that it's destructive and moral lead to negative outcomes?
Yeah, it's like a profound question to ask. And I have a friend and we like to go down these really like crazy like rabbit holes of philosophical discussions and she's a psychiatrist and like we talk about crazy stuff all the time. And she got really into AI art, right? And so we started talking about just like ethical reasons behind like why, what, and the humanity behind it, right? And it made us go back to researching that one engineer, and I don't remember his name, at Google that was working with AI. Josh, you remember his name? Yeah, we're talking about. No? Okay. So he, like, this was years ago. I want to say like 10 years ago. But he was working with AI systems then, and the conversation that he started having with this AI system that he was working with, he felt like it had become a being in itself. And all of a sudden, you know, he pulled out red flags, like higher ups, and started to say that this is a being. And everyone around him thought it was crazy. Everyone around him, you know, he kind of had to go into hiding, I think, because even what happened, like, it's a really sad story when you kind of like research what had happened to this man. And we thought about like how these are the fundamental questions we're having today. He was just ahead of the time, right? And I work in emerging technology. So I always feel like I'm like summer sitting in something that's like ahead of its time and people don't quite understand it yet. And I think that's where he was at that point in time. And a lot of people turned on him and didn't believe him. But I think that we probably need to figure out what he experienced, because the more and more we get intimate with this technology, because he's very intimate with the technology, the more and more we might start to have that same type of feeling towards it. You should look it up. I'll look it up for you. I'll find it for you and I'll give it to you. Because the conversation he had was, you would find it really interesting. But I don't know, it's not an answer for you. It's more of a like, if you are interested in this, there's a rabbit hole you can go down that I can help you get to. So.
I think there was an interview that Elon Musk did recently where he was talking about this conversation he had with the creator of OpenAI, which he helped fund and everything for a while, and then backed out eventually. And I think one of the things he said was because the CEO called him a speciesist because he was prioritizing humans over AI. So I would consider myself a speciesist. I do think that no fault to Albert back here, but I feel like I have more to contribute than Albert to the world, I hope. As an individual human being with cells and stuff, but so that's my short answer, is I'm a speciesist and humans are better at. But I think it's a great point that, so I graduated computer science, more of a programmer probably than an artist. I wish I was more of an artist at least. And I understand that like programs don't have bugs, people put bugs in programs. And so I do think there's an infusion of humanity that if there is an element of it that's evil or, you know, bad, or if it turns into this monster, it's probably because of some biases or some mistakes that were made on the human side of things. I don't think it can, from a code-based standpoint, become evil on its own unless it's programmed to do so. I don't know. I've also watched Terminator way too many times. I think that's not true.
What I learned from that interaction is that Caleb, who's interning in my company, is way smarter. That's going to do my job. That's my contribution.
Well, and we as animators, we really love to anthropomorphize things. Like, we know the cars aren't alive. And yet we have a movie called Cars. There's three of them. I kind of cried at the third one. So I totally get that question. AI was asked about this. I saw a video of, would you like to be a human? And the AI said, I would not like to be a human because being a human is hard. And so I think we also need to realize that we can't treat AI like humans because AI is not human, right? We have different needs than it has. Like, all it needs is electricity and more data to keep running, right? And it can actually kind of create more data for itself too. So yeah, I think that that's a very interesting conversation to be had, very deep. Does anybody have a last question?
Can you comment on SKF?
What are your thoughts on the speed of content creation as is? And what do you think will happen with the use of AI increasing our speeds even more? Like, what is the essential cost, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if you're on that. I think before you start asking questions, my thing is that there's a value to going slow. There's a reason why every motivational speaker tells you the story of Doris and the Hare. There's a timeless principle in that story. And I think we should also consider that when we talk about it. Yes, you guys read that, you know.
Yeah, it's tricky because I definitely think that there is a skill set that like needs to be perfected. You can tell the difference between somebody who's like animated something and that's their craft versus an AI system that animated something and it's not their craft per se, or they haven't, the algorithm hasn't gotten good enough to make it look like it's humanistic yet, right? I guess it's more of a statement. It's funny though because like I literally was having a conversation with the other day, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah. So, like, wait, how many of you guys are writers again? And, you know, all these people are like, different people are all have the ability to rig, they all know how to rig, they all studied rigging in school and have done it professionally. None of them want to do it. They're like, I found an AI tool that'll help me rig it, and it'll do the first pass, and then I can go back and tweak it and make it better, right? So, I mean, that was a literal artist who, part of the reason why they were hired is because they're a rigger and can rig, who sees this part of their job that they just don't like to do and can go back and let it do the first pass and get like probably 50% of the way with the AI system and then go and deliver it the rest of the way it's supposed to be done, right? So for that artist, like, they felt empowered by that tool to be able to use that type of workflow and to get there faster. So it's weird, it's a hard conversation of saying slower is better, because I'm like, but is it? I don't know, like this particular person who is legitimately a rigger, that is their craft, wants a tool that will help them get it done faster so that they can go back and do that second pass and really bring in the polish, right? They don't want to have to do the first pass. I think about it almost as like in like film of editing, you have like your first pass editor who's usually a junior, and then you have the senior that comes in and does like the next passes and cleans it up and all that kind of stuff, right? Is that first pass going to be done by an AI tool? Is the question I have, right? And is that bad? As long as we're not eliminating a job and it's just helping someone in their job, and that artist wants that help. I don't know if it's bad. So, like I said, I'm on the fence. I'm in a gray zone when it comes to certain things. But legitimately talking to an artist about that's the interaction I have.
I think there's a balance of slow and speed, depending on what you're working on. Like, because that rigger has a tool that can help him do the stuff he doesn't want to do, then he can spend more time on the stuff that he really does enjoy about the rigging process and make sure he's thorough. So yeah, but to go all speed or all slow, I think it's a good balance. Another good example of this is we can build buildings faster than we ever could in the history of humanity. But what are the buildings we go to see?
Yeah.
What are the buildings tourists go to see?
Historical ones.
Historical ones, ones that took a lot of craft and time. But they had, in order to build those buildings, they had to speed up something to get to the process where they could build that building. So it's a great debate to have again.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that there's value in slowness, I think, to the creator more so than the consumer. I think the consumer, we don't really care how long a movie took to make. We just want to know humans made it and that it resonates with us and it makes us cry and it's about cars. But the actual creator of it, there's tons of value in that slowness. And for sure, that I've seen that manifest in film studio and marketing and game design. The fact that you can't just make a game by snapping your finger makes you think about it longer, makes you be more deliberate, and makes you make better quality than if you could just say, hey, I want to make this VR game that does this thing, and let's roll it out tomorrow. So I think there is going to be problems when mass production is so fast, people are just spitting it out. I think the thing that's valuable to the consumer is uniqueness. And you think about like Charlie Bit My Finger or whatever, you know, it was like everyone loved that for a long time because it was a unique, like virality was unique at that time for home video. I'd imagine if that came out today, it would get, you know, maybe a few million views or whatever. It wouldn't be a big deal. But back then it was like this thing that everybody knows. And I think it'll be kind of the same, like the more people are able just to regurgitate and spit out and vomit out artwork, the less valuable it becomes. And then the things that will rise to the surface are the things that are unique that may or may not have taken more time because we'll have to reinvent what art truly is.
Yeah, I think you guys have turned me a little bit. I think when that question was posed, my thought was, I'm gonna zing them with slower is not better, better is better, right? That was gonna be my thing. But I then imagine myself, you know, looking at a piece of art that somebody's made, like a building, right? That somebody poured their love into. You can tell a masterpiece made out of tiny little pieces of cut up paper, right? You can just tell, wow, like there's value in just like appreciating the amount of love that's there. And then imagining that exact same piece of art, maybe even better, created by a computer. And it just totally like rips the soul out of that. So I do think there's value there. I think it's more about the love and attention being put into something. And I guess slowness sometimes equates to the love and attention. I think I was thinking of Disney a lot, right? Disney is putting out so many films and I feel like they're kind of getting worse. Right? So, like, I don't care how fast they make them, but just make them good, right? So that's where my gut reaction was of, you know, just better is better. Make a good movie, Disney, come on.
That list of what do we need to do that was, I think, was really phenomenal, but there's a clear, almost every one of those were not things that I, as a practitioner, cannot do of my own volition. So you can answer it with one number or explain on that. What percentage do you feel you, in your role as leaders of your own company or leaders in this industry or leaders in this area, what percentage do you feel should be dedicated to your time to both your employees, but also the greater community to ensure that those things actually occur? And why?
Yeah, so I mentioned this earlier, but I tend to do a lot of speaking. I go to professional conferences, I speak at colleges, schools, classrooms. I spoke at NYU not too long ago. Like, I do lots of speaking engagements so that I can have these conversations and bring up these things, especially with the people who are in the middle of it. They're the ones trying to figure out their lives, right? Like I'm sure a bunch of you right now are trying to figure out your lives. You're at that like pivotal point of understanding why this even matters for you, right? And so just having people think about it a little bit more critically is the part where I kind of come from is, and also bringing that type of, because this is just who I am. So like when I join a team or a new project, I'm like, hey, this is what you get. But I also got hired because this is who I am, right? I do bring up these ethical questions when I'm sitting in a room discussing things with artists, discussing things with stakeholders, discussing things with people who are funding projects. Like, I bring up these concerns and want to have these conversations, and I'm willing to put my neck on the line and know that I might piss some people off, but it's primarily just to make sure that like we are thinking about it ethically and that we are taking different points of view into consideration, because the artists half the time aren't the ones that have the studio, and they're not the ones doing the fundraising or having to have this hard conversations with stakeholders, but I sometimes get to sit in that room, so I try to have that. I try to bring that voice to the table when I can.
I think it's, as a business owner, I spend probably more time than I should sometimes thinking about the individuals in my company. I think it's very important, and the onus is on me to provide value to the world so that we can then have dollars to pay those employees. Because as much as I want to care about somebody and how they're feeling today, I need to make sure that those dollars are coming in. And I think that can only happen with art, specifically with this category, if we're providing a value or a service outside of us. So I think probably should be 50-50 as an owner of a company, as a manager, that I'm thinking about these types of things and what the future holds for all those people. I get a little probably too personal, because that's who I am too. I don't know. And maybe that's why it's valuable. It's hard to tell.
Oof, yeah, I feel like that's a tough question for me. I think there's a lot of like systemic, bigger issues that need to be solved. And let's be honest, I don't feel like I'm not very smart. Like, I don't think I'm the guy to solve those. I'm happy to be part of the conversation, but I'm not educated enough and I don't know the system well enough to actually go out and solve that myself. But I would be a great cheerleader and I'm happy to be involved in the conversation. What I have control over is what I have control over. I have a little business and I have a family, and that's as far as I really tend to see to a fault. And I agree, yeah. I should probably be spending a lot more time thinking about my employees. I do think about them a lot. And I think the ratio is probably, there's work to be done, right? Making sure that they're taken care of, making sure that their concerns are heard, and that there's an environment that's open enough for them to feel like they can come forward and say when they're not comfortable with things. I have had artists actually say, hey, I'm not comfortable with us using AI in this way. We were exploring, right, we do a lot of art for the LDS Church, and we have used AI as part of our process for doing work for the church and exploring concepts. And I had an artist approach me and say, I don't feel comfortable with this. It doesn't feel right to me. And like, AI Jesus doesn't feel great for some reason. And I agree, I don't disagree. It's hard for me to put a finger on why, but I agree, it feels weird. And so, I don't know, I hope that I can create an environment for my employees that feel comfortable.
I will tell you that there are employers out there, though, like, this is how I operate. The first person I hired at a company I was supposed to build was actually the least skilled person because of what an amazing person she was. I knew that this was a very difficult company to build. The culture of the company was very, what an artist would call toxic. The company loved their culture because they were salesy, right? And so I knew that the person I needed was this very optimistic person, and she was my first hire. And I knew I could train her to get her skills to where they needed to be. But the thing I valued the most was my interactions with her and what I knew she brought to every day working with her. So remember, you know, get your skills up to par, but also how you interact with people is huge, okay? And we have to end there. Thank you, Dana and Michael and Chaz, for being on the show. And how I always end the live cast is, until next time, I hope we all get a little wiser.
Thank you for watching the Directing Animation Livecast, hosted by Scott Weiser. Audio version edited by Kira Horowitz. Copyright Scott Weiser, LLC 2023. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube and ring that notification bell.